This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, as the war continues in Gaza, Jewish and Palestinian groups react to the Foreign Minister's indication that Australia may recognise a Palestinian state. Also, the AFL cracks down on homophobic sledges, hitting one player with a three-match ban. And ancient Aboriginal pottery gives us new insights into the history of Indigenous Australians.
And we were just all looking at each other. We couldn't believe it. But more significantly, maybe some of the earliest evidence in Australia of international trade.
There have been strong reactions from lobby groups to the Foreign Minister's comments indicating Australia is considering recognising Palestinian statehood in the hope it may expedite a peace process in Gaza. Some in the Palestinian community are calling Penny Wong's remarks a shallow political answer to a deeply complex problem, while Jewish groups say their timing is inappropriate given there's no sign of an end to the brutal war. This report from Stephanie Smale.
As the deadly Gaza conflict rolls on, global leaders are searching for answers. Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong has floated Palestinian statehood as a vital part of the solution.
What is the path to peace? I don't see, ultimately, any security for Israel without the issue of Palestinian statehood being resolved.
So what would statehood look like and how would it help stop the war? The finer details could be years away, but broadly it would mean recognising the occupied Palestinian territories that include the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as an independent state. Palestinian advocate Farhad Ali argues it's not that simple though.
If you were to tomorrow declare that Australia recognises a Palestinian state, that would actually change absolutely nothing on the ground.
A so-called two-state solution would make Israel a neighbour to Palestinians rather than an overseer. But Farhad Ali explains separating the lives of Palestinians and Israelis who've been living together in the territories for so long isn't an option. And he's not convinced Israel will ever recognise a two-state solution anyway.
By talking about a two-state solution, we get further and further away from the actual structural issues. We're not talking about the settlements. We're not talking about the grotesque violence that is being delivered to Palestinians. We're not talking about any of the issues that actually make up the situation. So I cannot foresee a situation in which recognition of Palestine would actually generate any change on the ground.
Penny Wong says Hamas can't be part of any discussion about establishing a Palestinian state. But Farhad Ali points out finding a solution without Hamas is unlikely.
I think we need to be talking about, well, why does this group exist in the first place? What is it doing? How did it come about? And why does it have so much support? It's improbable and possibly impossible to foresee a situation in which it is eliminated completely. And even if that were to become the case, it may be that there would be another group to take its place.
Professor Bob Bowker, a former Australian ambassador to Jordan, Egypt and Syria, supports the idea of Palestinian statehood, but he's not convinced a discussion about it now will help build momentum for a two-state solution. And he warns it's likely Hamas will emerge as the strongest political actor in Gaza after the war.
At the moment, Hamas's great advantage is, in fact, the Israeli occupation. The indignities, the humiliation, the absence of opportunity for Palestinians, and it will draw increased support as a result of the carnage we have seen in Gaza.
Australia's criticism of Israel has been building slowly as the civilian death toll climbs. It escalated further after an Israeli airstrike killed an Australian aid worker last week. Although Penny Wong says Palestinian statehood talks could help stop the bloodshed, Jewish groups argue it's a premature move. Daniel Agion is the president of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry.
Everybody wants to see a two-state solution with Israelis and Palestinians living side by side in peace. But at the moment, there's a war on.
He argues floating the idea of statehood without firm ideas of how a Palestinian state would work doesn't help.
Who's the government? Well, it's not Hamas. It's not going to be the Palestinian Authority in its current environment. The foreign minister acknowledges all of that. So there isn't that partner for peace, for dialogue.
Daniel Agion agrees with Penny Wong's claim that Australia can be a friend to Israel and to Palestinians. But he's not convinced talks about statehood are the best step to take right now.
You can't negotiate with people holding hostages and engaging in acts of warfare.
The federal opposition argues it's dangerous to reward Hamas's barbaric conduct by recognising Palestinian statehood. Its foreign affairs spokesman Simon Birmingham says there's a list of things that need to happen before those discussions can begin.
And those preconditions are the removal of Hamas, the security environment providing confidence for all parties that they will not be subject to terrorist attack, and clarity that all those in government positions across Palestinian territories respect Israel's basic right to exist, and that is not the case at present.
The opposition's foreign affairs spokesman, Simon Birmingham. That report from Stephanie Smale. Ian Parmiter is a research scholar at the Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University and a former Australian ambassador to Lebanon. He describes Senator Wong's speech and her remarks on the possibility of Australia recognising Palestinian statehood as nuanced.
She certainly is a long way from saying that the Australian government has made a decision to recognise Palestine as an independent state, but she makes out the case for doing that, which I think is actually quite cogent. The point she makes is that the peace process that started in 1993 with the Oslo process really has failed. And that process had recognition of a Palestinian state and a two-state solution right at the end of the process. What the foreign minister is talking about now is trying to put recognition of a Palestinian state at the start of the process. Now, she's not doing this in a vacuum. This has been considered carefully by the British government and David Cameron. He's very, very interested in the idea.
Do you agree with Senator Wong when she says that international recognition of Palestine as a state would help build momentum towards a two-state solution?
I've been working in the Middle East since 1976, and I've never been an optimist. But a point I would make is that this is a new approach for major Western countries to begin looking at reversing the Oslo process, which seemed to be a good one back in the 1990s when it occurred. We'll just have to see how it develops. We don't know if Australia is definitely going to push for recognition. Wong has simply made out the case, and she's made the case strongly that Hamas cannot be a part of it.
But how likely is it that Hamas will be eradicated and have no role in Palestine?
That's a big question. One can't be optimistic about that at this stage. Hamas is very far from being destroyed, despite the fact that that's been the aim of the Israeli military campaign for the last 6 months. And even more worryingly for Israel and for many of us, Hamas has actually got stronger in the West Bank, where it wasn't strong before. Before October, Hamas had a 12% support in the West Bank. A poll in December showed that support had risen to 44%. It well may be over 50% now. We really don't know whether it's even feasible for Hamas to be destroyed. And if it can't be, that's going to be a big problem in trying to make a two-state solution work.
We've seen the protests against the Netanyahu government. Is there a chance, do you think, that his government will fall and elections will be held?
Well, there is a very good chance it could fall.
If there is a change of government, is recognition of Palestine as a state and a two-state solution more likely or less likely?
Israeli politician most favoured by the opinion polls is Benny Gantz, and he's a pragmatist. He would see which way the wind is blowing. He gets on well with the Americans, and the Americans trust him. It will may be that there'd be a way of working the international community and Palestinian moderates working with Gantz. But, I mean, I do want to emphasise that the difficulties in face of all this are enormous. It's not just Israeli domestic politics, and, of course, Israelis are traumatised by what happened on the 7th of October. It's also the fact that it's going to be extremely difficult to get the two parties talking to each other in any way. So it's not, whatever happens is not going to happen soon.
Ian Parmiter from the ANU's Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies. Well, after weeks of uncertainty, Tasmania's Liberal Premier Jeremy Rockliff has struck a crucial deal with the Jackie Lambie Network as he attempts to form a new government. Last month, Australia's only remaining Liberal government clung onto power in an early Tasmanian election, but it's been forced to negotiate with an expanded crossbench to shore up support. Mr Rockliff still needs the backing of one more MP to form government, but that hasn't stopped him from unveiling his new cabinet, and it includes a veteran of federal politics. Gavin Coote has more.
After trading barbs in the weeks leading up to the recent election, the Tasmanian Liberal Party and the Jackie Lambie Network have made peace.
As I've said before, this is a new era of cooperation and collaboration.
Liberal Premier Jeremy Rockliff has struck a deal with the three new Jackie Lambie Network MPs, which means he only needs the support of one more MP to govern Tasmania. While it's still unclear who that might be, the Premier has today gone ahead and unveiled his new cabinet. Among the additions is Erica Betts, the former federal Liberal minister who has resurrected his political career, winning a seat in the state parliament. The Liberal Party's deal with Jackie Lambie's MPs guarantees they'll give his government support in all no-confidence motions, as well as votes on budget measures.
It's an agreement that provides stability and certainty, and I'm confident it's an agreement that reflects what they've brought to the table.
As part of the agreement, the Minor Party, which campaigned largely on the issue of transparency, has also won some guarantees. They include extra staff for their own offices, along with reviews of the state's finances and the proposed AFL stadium in Hobart. Independent MP Christy Johnston, who was a vocal critic of the Liberals in the last term of Parliament, is scathing of the Jackie Lambie Network's decision.
Which silences them and gags them and makes them nothing more than puppets of the Liberal Party.
She says the agreement leaves Tasmanians with what she calls a coalition government that has a blank cheque to do what it wants.
Look, it's incredibly important that I think the entire Parliament understand the will of the Tasmanian people at this election. They didn't have confidence in the Rockliff government to elect a majority Rockliff government. They are very concerned about integrity and transparency. So it is on the crossbench and the members of the crossbench to uphold those concerns and to hold this Parliament to account.
Dr. Richard Herr is a political analyst with the University of Tasmania.
To some extent, I believe the Premier has replicated the exact circumstances that brought his government to an early election this time, that there will be too many independent actors who believe that they knew what they were agreeing to, but try to renegotiate that as particular events come up.
Dr. Herr says it's still unclear how the Jackie Lambie Network will be able to co-govern with the Liberals.
The biggest difficulty, I think, is, first of all, it's such a new party. The leader is in Canberra, and they really didn't come into the election with any wish list. They came in with the promise that, well, they didn't have many policies they wanted to put forward, but they would keep the government honest. They're now in a position, or at least Premier Rockliff is in a position, where the people who are going to keep the government honest are now inside the tent with him.
And this agreement is only for 12 months. How does this bode for, I guess, the chances of having stable government for the entirety of the term?
I think that's the critical issue for a Liberal government. The fact is that Liberal governments typically tout their expertise in being managers, safe in investment environments and managers of the economy. And who's going to commit to projects in Tasmania that last for more than 12 months if they believe this agreement is basically only for 12 months? It'll be an investment headache for the financial community, but it'll also be an issue for the government.
And they still need another seat in order to shore up a majority. Who can the Liberals look to beyond Jackie Lambie Network?
The only two that they really have are an ex-Labor, David O'Byrne, and Christy Johnson. Oh, and sorry, and of course, there's got Craig Garland, the fishing industry person, independent.
The Jackie Lambie Network MPs were unavailable for an interview. In a statement, they say they look forward to working with the Rockliffe government to serve the best interests of all Tasmanians. Today, the Tasmanian Labor Party chose a new leader following its fourth straight election loss, with Dean Winter endorsed unopposed for the top job.
That report from Gavin Coote. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a discovery in Queensland suggests Indigenous Australians may have been trading with foreign travellers much earlier than previously thought. To the AFL now, and Port Adelaide forward Jeremy Finlayson has been banned for 3 games after using a homophobic slur against an Essendon player on the weekend. It's the second such scandal to hit the AFL this year, after North Melbourne coach Alistair Clarkson was fined for making a homophobic comment in March. Advocates for the gay community are calling for changes to the way AFL players are educated on the issue. This report from Angus Randall.
The AFL's Gather Round was supposed to be a celebration of South Australian football, but it's been marred by a homophobia scandal after Port Adelaide forward Jeremy Finlayson used a slur against an Essendon player on Friday night.
Well, there's a natural element of disappointment. You know, we had a fantastic game on Friday night that has in many ways been lost.
Port's general manager for football, Chris Davies, says the club supports the 3-match ban handed down by the AFL today.
Jeremy was keen to accept responsibility for the incident, which included accepting the suspension that came with that.
It's the AFL's second homophobia incident in as many months. In March, North Melbourne coach Alistair Clarkson was handed a 2-game suspended sentence and a $20,000 fine for allegedly using a homophobic slur during a practice match. Jason Ball is a former amateur footballer who came out as gay in 2012 and has been campaigning for the AFL to do more to stamp out homophobia.
Homophobic slurs like the one that Finlayson used on Friday night, they're the reason that I stayed in the closet as a young footballer. To me, it's no wonder that no male AFL player has felt comfortable to come out when incidents like this are still happening in 2024.
Earlier this week, Jeremy Finlayson said he would educate himself about his language.
Yeah, just continuing to reflect and improving myself and just getting all the education that I can to make myself better.
It's not the first time a player has promised to seek education when they're in trouble. Adelaide Crows star Tex Walker said something similar when he was banned for 6 games for a racist remark 3 years ago. Port Adelaide general manager Chris Davies says players already get enough education on what's right and wrong.
Jeremy has been in the AFL competition for 10 years. He's done enough training to know that what he said was wrong.
Brett McElhinney is from the South Australian Rainbow Advocacy Alliance and a former president of the Adelaide Crows LGBT plus supporter group. He wants to see the AFL change the way it educates players to ensure they understand the weight of an offhand remark.
A lot of people have tried to concentrate on changing people's attitudes, but we actually know that most people actually aren't homophobic. They don't want to make LGBTIQA plus people unsafe or feel excluded. So it's actually the behaviours that we actually need to be focusing on. We really need to remove this casual homophobia that's in and around sport.
Jeremy Finlayson says he knew immediately he'd done the wrong thing, but Brett McElhinney says even if it's not coming from a place of hate, it still hurts.
Using that language, we know that you don't mean anything by it, but unfortunately, it adds to the overall impact that a lot of our community members receive from so many different aspects of their life. They don't feel comfortable, and we do know that LGBTQA plus males participating in sport is at half the rate of the general population. So there's a long way that we really need to go.
There's never been an openly gay player in the AFL men's comp. And while the AFLW holds a pride round every year, there's no pride round in the men's league. Jason Ball says that especially after a week like this, the AFL needs to do more to make the LGBT plus community feel welcome.
The AFL needs to understand that this is not just a problem at the elite level of the game. This goes all the way down to the grassroots and it starts at a very young age. And so education programs targeting just adults just at the elite level, it's not going to change a culture. We need to see programs both at the elite level and at the grassroots level to be proactive about creating an inclusive environment for LGBTQ people in sport, like Pride Games, like Pride Rounds, as a means to send a more welcoming message and to show players, you know, where the AFL stands on this issue.
Jeremy Finlayson will be available to play against Adelaide on the 2nd of May.
Angus Randall reporting. The findings of an archaeological dig in northern Queensland are changing our understanding of ancient Aboriginal technology and trade. On an island in the Great Barrier Reef's north, researchers have uncovered the oldest pottery ever found in Australia. They think it's between 2,000 and 3,000 years old and say it suggests Aboriginal communities engaged in international trade far earlier than previously thought. This report from Nick Grimm.
This is the south section.
Yep.
So this is this wall here.
Perfect.
On a windswept headland overlooking the sea, archaeologists have been scraping back delicate layers of history to unearth a discovery shattering preconceptions about ancient Aboriginal technology and trade.
And that's what we're drawing at the moment.
Oh, wow.
So it was laying flat, all broken up, surrounded by shells. And we were just looking at each other. We couldn't believe it.
That's distinguished Professor Sean Ulm from James Cook University, the chief investigator with the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Australian Biodiversity and Heritage, is describing the moment archaeologists found shards of pottery deep inside a midden located on Yiggaroo, also known as Lizard Island, 33 kilometres off the Australian mainland in the Coral Sea.
Level, Sean.
Half a mil out.
We began excavating this archaeological site. There was no sign of any pottery until we got 40 centimetres below the surface. And as we began really carefully excavating, we found more and more pieces of pottery going down another 40 centimetres until we had over 80 pieces of pottery in total. But all of this is actually rock, so we're not going to draw that in for the moment.
But what really excited the team was the age of the pottery and the fact it contained local materials. It was made here and not brought to these shores. Previously, the oldest ceramics found anywhere in Australia were thought to be around 1,700 years old.
This find at Yiggaroo on Lizard Island is between 1,800 and 2,900 years ago, so significantly older. So it places it as the oldest securely dated pottery ever found in Australia. So that has lots of significance for how we understand Aboriginal people engaging in technology. But more significantly, our findings suggest that the knowledge of how to make that pottery came from those Aboriginal First Nations communities being connected to other First Nations communities around the rim of the Coral Sea, indicating maybe some of the earliest evidence in Australia of international trade.
Discovery of pottery artefacts found on Yiggaroo, it was a surprise to myself, my people, something that we thought we'd never find on country, you know.
Kenneth McLean is a Dengal man and director of the Wollumbah Aboriginal Corporation. For him, the discovery has special significance.
We grew up knowing the stories of our old people. It was passed down through generations and, you know, it gives us a clear understanding of what was happening not only a few hundred years ago, but a few thousand years ago on country.
There's some fish bones, some bony jaw parts in section in this one.
And with radiocarbon dating showing the archaeological site provides evidence of human habitation up to 6,000 years ago, the researchers believe those living on the island had already developed sophisticated methods of making sea voyages well out to sea.
While we were digging, we were thinking of the enormous implications of what we were finding. And, you know, I have to admit a sense of great, you know, responsibility to the community for how special this place is and what a special place it holds in the history of Australia. And there is so much we don't know about our continent that finds like this from a single site, from a single island, can challenge lots of things we think we know about the past.
That's Distinguished Professor Sean Ulm from James Cook University. That report from Nick Grimm and John Daly. The man who first suggested the existence of the so-called God particle has died at the age of 94. Theoretical physicist Peter Higgs proposed his Higgs boson theory in the 1960s to help explain how matter formed after the Big Bang. It would be almost half a century before his theory was confirmed. Here's Rachel Hayter.
When physicist Peter Higgs first proposed his revolutionary theory in the 1960s, it struggled to find a place in scientific journals, partly because hardly anyone understood it. It took almost 50 years for his explanation of why things have mass to be proven as fact.
We have a discovery. We should state it. We have a discovery. We have observed a new particle consistent with a Higgs boson.
The eyes of the then 83-year-old welled, wiping his glasses as his groundbreaking contribution to science was confirmed to the world in 2012.
I would like to add my congratulations to everybody involved in this tremendous achievement. For me, it's really an incredible thing that it's happened in my lifetime.
He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics a year later and praised by fellow theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking.
I would like to congratulate Peter Higgs for winning the Nobel Prize for predicting the existence of a particle.
The Higgs boson is a fundamental particle, the existence of which explains why other particles and therefore all the stars and planets in the universe have mass. Higgs boson affects different particles in different ways. While light passes right through, some particles get bogged down, and that's what gives them mass. If that still doesn't make sense, here's how children's news program Behind the News explained Higgs the year it was found.
You could think of those tiny particles like a celebrity at a party. At the start of the party, Justin Bieber rocks up by himself, so he has no mass. But as he enters and starts mingling, everyone huddles around him to get a closer look. The people following Bieber are like Higgs boson particles, and they give mass to the Bieber particle in the room.
Another helpful metaphor is snow. The Higgs field is a paddock covered in snow. A skier glides through with ease. An elderly woman shuffles through slowly. A bird flies over the field untouched. Each snowflake is a Higgs boson particle. The skier, the elderly woman, and the bird are all different kinds of particles: electrons, bosons, and photons. Their mass is determined by their interaction with the snow, or Higgs boson. The 27-kilometre-long tunnel containing the particle collider, where this elementary particle was discovered, lies beneath the border between Switzerland and France.
The holy grail of our field, what was in the experiment that discovered the Higgs.
Elisabetta Barberio is a professor of physics at the University of Melbourne. She was among the scientists working on those pivotal experiments.
We were working 24 hours a day, so I was in Australia and there were the people at CERN.
CERN is the European Organisation for Nuclear Research. Their Large Hadron Collider produces collisions with extraordinarily high energies, mimicking some of the conditions present in the trillionths of seconds after the Big Bang.
When the Europeans were going to sleep, we would wake up and keep going. It was like Christmas, you know, you have a Christmas tree, you have a present and you want to open, and at a certain point you realise it is exactly what you wanted.
Professor Barberio is now the director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for Dark Matter, running experiments a kilometre beneath the ground in a former gold mine in Victoria's Wimmera region, searching for another mysterious substance.
Most probably the majority of the mass of the universe, I would say, more than two-thirds, is not of the particle like proton or neutron or electron or atom that we know and we observe.
It's research that builds on the work done all those years ago. The University of Edinburgh, where Peter Higgs was an emeritus professor, says he died peacefully at home after a short illness. He was 94.
Rachel Hayter reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Drugs, sex, and lavish dinners out. News organisations paying for interviews is hardly new, but the allegations about what Channel 7's Spotlight programme gave to Bruce Lehrman for a sit-down interview are surprising to say the least. Today, Media Watch host Paul Barry unpacks what's unfolded. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.